So oftentimes the way that I come up with a sermon idea is I come up with a clever little title and then find myself backed in a corner as to what I'm going to say about that. And this week was no exception. I thought it was really cute to come up with the idea of making peace with mammon. And then I had to do something with that. So thank you for the challenge. Mammon is defined as wealth regarded as an evil influence or false object of worship and devotion. It was taken by medieval writers as the name of the devil of covetousness. The word comes from the Greek mammonus, with similar roots existing in Hebrew, Latin, Aramaic, Chaldean, and Syriac. Mammon is money, wealth, and material possessions. I don't think it is much of a stretch to say that I think many of us have complicated relationships with money, wealth, and material possessions. In the Gospels, Jesus did not have too many nice things to say about wealth and the people who have it. Several of the parables that he told as teaching stories had to do with young rich rulers who were more attached to their wealth than to the life-changing teachings of this itinerant preacher. I imagine that even if you aren't a Bible scholar, you've heard the adage that it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. I thought that was a spectacular cartoon. Because that's definitely how I would think to do it. Okay. Although I've heard many a sermon trying to stretch the meaning of the eye of the needle to be a gate in Jerusalem and therefore big enough for several camels to pass through, the rest of Jesus' teachings are pretty clear as to where he stood with regard to money and power. In the Sermon on the Mount, he urged his followers not to store up wealth on earth, but to turn their good deeds into treasures in heaven, reminding them that where their treasure is, their heart would be also. That sounds so familiar. Asserting that people cannot serve both God and mammon, money, wealth, power, Jesus subscribes to the don't worry, be happy philosophy, telling his followers not to worry about material needs because, like the birds of the air and the lilies of the field, God would provide. I tell you all of this not because I think you will be swayed one way or another with these biblical tidbits, but because they have deeply informed my relationship to money. The disregard for material wealth and the elevation of poverty to a sort of badge of honor or a sign of spiritual maturity was very much part of the narrative that I grew up with. Both of my parents were born into poor, blue-collar working families. Both of my grandfathers worked in factories, one on the line at Blackstone, making radiators, and the other a foreman for Jamestown Lounge, designing and making furniture. My father was the first of his family to attend college, becoming an art teacher, a profession that provided greater security for our family. But the mythos of poverty ran so deep in that side of the family that my dad's mother could never find it in herself to be proud of his accomplishments, and would routinely blame all manner of tax increases and other annoyances in the village on those damn teachers who got more than they deserved. Unquote. My family's stories of making do with nothing have taken on the stature of Paul Bunyan myths and are recounted every time we are together. I'm sure my daughter could give a dandy, dramatic recitation of how her grandparents, my parents, overcame adversity. The adversity was real. The overcoming was real. But the mythos has grown. So maybe you can relate to this. In my family, money was so much more than money. Money was love. Money was mysterious. Money was something to be saved because money was unpredictable and scarce. Money was love. It could be given or it could be withheld, but it always had meaning. Money was mysterious. In my family, my mother paid all of the bills and was the money monitor. My father had no access to the money he earned and rarely had more than $5 in his pocket. Money was saved. My grandfather, who was the foreman in the furniture-making factory, made next to nothing. But he managed to tie the full 10% to his church and put money into savings. When Les and I needed a loan to purchase our first home, it was my grandfather who, with some wheedling, provided the cash. And you can bet we repaid every penny with interest, because you don't just give money away, because money was scarce. The memory of having no money can be readily called upon, and is. Can you see how these family assumptions about money might have influenced my relationship with money and material possessions? My maternal grandparents were deeply religious, so the biblical narratives played heavily into those family money assumptions. So I would like you to, on your first piece of paper, to write down an answer to this prompt. In my family, money was... I realize that in asking you to participate in this, that I am asking you to risk a great deal. Our ideas about money are sometimes mysteries in themselves. And I know that it can be triggering to hear about money from a pulpit. And I just want you to know that I respect that this can be a challenge for you. I hope that as we progress through this service, that you will find that this is truly a spiritual practice and endeavor as we try to get to the roots of why we feel about this energy source that we call money, that we purchase sustenance and experiences with, that we can begin to understand where those feelings come from. So thank you for trusting me in this process. As you know, as I've mentioned today, we are in the second week of our church's annual stewardship campaign. That's the time when we make pledges, promises, of financial support to the ministries of this congregation. Each of us brings into the mix our relationship with money. We bring our anxieties as much as we bring our generosity. We bring our skepticism as much as we bring our faith. We bring all those voices in our head about the value of money, as well as our consumerist culture's assumptions about what it means to get what we pay for. It's amazing we have enough seats in the chapel for all those influences and voices. Here at church, I need to pay attention to my own assumptions about money because they have a direct correlation to my comfort or discomfort asking you to give. I believe that the work we do together, and I believe that in the transformational potential of Unitarian Universalism. But sometimes, those voices in my head that think that money is mysterious and scarce, those voices get in the way. I have to remind myself that, like we discovered in our time for all ages, we each give as we can. And whether you have the resources to give a big rock or fill in those little spaces with sand, it does take all of us. Knowing that every gift is essential helps me to encourage you to participate in the life of this congregation through your giving, not only of your treasure, but of your time and your talent. If there was a thing that I could wish for all of us, it would be to be able to communicate the deep spirituality of giving and the satisfaction of contributing to something larger than any of us. Those are just a few of the ways that I fill in the blank to our next prompt, which will be page 2 in your packet. At church, I fill in the blank regarding money. You might write about your feelings. I feel good. I feel anxious. I hate when I have to hear sermons. These are your packets. I'm not going to be taking them. I don't have that much self-esteem. I can't take that. So be as honest as you want. So we've examined our family history with money and our feelings around money at church. Now I want to give you an opportunity to reflect on any ahas you may have had about the subject of money so far today, and more importantly, your relationship to money. So feel free to jot things down. This is now page 3 in your packet. I'm going to share a bit about my own reflections, some of my own ahas, and maybe they will inspire an aha from you. I realize that scarcity thinking has been a big part of my experience with money. Because of my family narrative and our experience with lack, it is very easy for me to project that onto others. It is that belief in scarcity that makes me feel tongue-tied when I chat with individuals about giving to the ministries of the church. And then I remember our science experiment, the rocks, the pebbles, the sand. And I realize that my ambivalence can result in denying someone the opportunity to experience giving as a spiritual practice. And you know, encouraging your spiritual growth is my primary job. Remembering that gives me a different perspective. And I have to say, it is a much more affirming and life-giving perspective. So you can write your ahas or draw cartoons, whatever it is that you're doing, as I continue. Because all of the complicatedness around money in my life also includes some gifts. And one of the greatest gifts that my family has given me regarding money has been to not be afraid to ask for help. For many of us, asking for help of any kind, but especially around our finances, can feel shameful, like we've flunked at being an adult. In a culture that idolizes those who are able to lift themselves up by their bootstraps, and really, what does that even mean? We can feel judged and unworthy when we need help. To balance our somewhat squirrely narratives about money, my family has demonstrated that giving and helping feels good. My ability to ask and to receive gracefully and gratefully fills their joy cup. I know this is true because it's how I feel with my own daughter. I would much rather help her while I am still around and see how it makes her life easier than to put off that help until after I'm gone. So take a moment and reflect on a gift that your family gave to you regarding money and your feelings around it, and note it on the 4th piece of paper in your packet. So far today, we have focused on our relationship with money, but we haven't really made peace with mammon yet. To remind us, mammon is defined as wealth regarded as an evil influence or false object of worship and devotion. In our earlier reading from Mark Nepo's The Book of Awakening, we learned that greed is not restricted to money. It can work its appetite on anything. When we believe we are behind or less than, we somehow start to want more than we need, as if what we don't have will fill in our pain and make us feel whole, as if the thing we haven't tasted will be the thing to bring us alive. The truth is that one experience taken to heart will satisfy our hunger to be loved by everyone. I think one of the cautions we must exercise in our faith is of wanting to experience more than any one person can, where we are endlessly searching and never satisfied. Our fourth principle, affirming and promoting a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, can easily devolve into a free-for-all at the all-you-can-eat buffet of religious ideas and experiences. My friend Jennifer used to quip that a free and responsible search is fine, but we shouldn't be afraid to find something. The broadness of our sources, our direct experience of wonder, inspiration from words and deeds of prophetic women and men that spur us to social justice, wisdom from world religions, Jewish and Christian teachings that teach us to love our neighbors as ourselves, an emphasis on reason and the findings of science as captured in humanism, and honoring earth-centered traditions that keep us in relationship with our planet. These sources that inform and influence Unitarian Universalism can even become a distraction and can become a form of greed. How can we possibly settle into a spiritual practice when there is so much to choose from? I believe it is an individual willingness to go deep, to choose not only the tasty bits, but to engage in spiritual discipline can help us transform an insatiable search into a responsible search for truth and meaning. Oops. Money, possessions, experiences, ideas. Mammon can wear many faces in our lives. The path to making peace with Mammon begins with exploring your relationship to it, based on family narrative, personal experience, and a willingness to reflect on your assumptions and expectations. Oh yeah, and to risk, and to be vulnerable. To begin to believe that there is enough, and that you are enough. One experience taken to heart can satisfy our hunger. And when we let that truth begin to settle into our hearts, we can joyfully take our place in our container experience. Because being at church is a container experience, where we bring our big rocks, our smaller pebbles, and our grains of sand to fill our container to overflowing. And if we do that, we can exceed our wildest dreams of fostering compassion and justice in ourselves and in the community. I believe we can make it so.